open up your ears and open up your mind. They'll reach into your throat and pull out your spine. And when the sun blows up and the earth is gone, you still experience grind.
I was going to say,
Kyle and Sean.
My immediate thought was Hell in a Cell, but I also, it's casket match. It almost has to be.
Or Inferno.
Inferno match is good too.
Yo, okay.
Buried Alive.
Real
is,
quick.
Actually, Buried Alive is probably...
I was about to ask, were the ones from the mid-90s with the Taker, were those casket matches when they tossed him into the hole in the ground, too?
No, those are Buried Alive just down matches.
It's just Buried Alive.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what made fire. Stone Cold, wasn't it? That's when he cut the promo.
No.
That was on Jake the Snake.
Yeah, that was Jake the Snake Roberts.
Oh, was it Jake
the
Snake? Okay.
Yeah, he won King of the Ring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow. I need a life.
No, it's okay. I'm confused. That's because I get most of my wrestling knowledge now from like Wrestling with Regret videos and or WrestleMania.
Okay.
It's fair.
I mean, yeah. I like the Wrestle with Regret guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love his stuff because he, you know, as I've said before, he's reviewing all of the old pay-per-views from my era. And that's what I really dig. So
I didn't realize until recently, like he does commentary and some like little indie fed too.
Uh-huh.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And he actually wrestled for a bit. He went to wrestling school. He was like trying to do it, but he wasn't very good. So then
is he the British guy?
No.
Okay. No.
You're thinking the British of guy Adam I like too. Something, right?
Huh?
Oh, you're talking that guy from or What Simon Culture Miller. Wrestling.
Yeah, What Culture guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that guy's good though. He's funny. No, Brian Zane was nowhere near that guy's level from what I understand.
Well, I mean, WrestleMania guy, or not the WrestleMania, the What Culture wrestling guy, Simon, I think he pissed off Haku once.
Oh, that sounds smart.
Yeah. I'm like,
that's Mang,
why?
Yeah?
No, you don't do that.
That's Mang, right?
Yes.
Yeah, don't do that. That's bad news bears.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask this real quick, and then we can go back into banter. Was this better than Tales from the Hood?
I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed Tales from the Hood as well.
Okay.
Because of a nostalgia reason. But this one was enjoyable for me because it's John Carpenter.
I feel like we'll get into it, but on a whole, yes, this was better than Tales from the Hood.
Yeah.
And now I have to go back for that awkward nine seconds of silence after Kyle.
No, I like to leave it.
I leave that in. Leave that in there. It's called dramatic.
I thought it was great. Yeah, because it did leave me with bated breath. That's not the way I imagined it going. So anyways, we've talked about him a lot on this show, guys. But what recently, or just thinking of it now, what would you say, like, your favorite scary game you've played is? I'm only asking this because I've been playing the Silent Hill 2 remake recently. And it also inspired me to finally buy this today.
Ooh, nice. Went back, got the Silent Hill PS3.
I've been really wanting to play Silent Hill 3. I've always said it's my favorite of the original trilogy. So I said, fuck it. It was on sale. It was $20 on Amazon.
Yeah.
So I snagged that. So I will also probably be probably streaming both those at some point in the near future. But
awesome.
As much as I love them, I don't know if Silent Hill's my favorite.
Interesting. In terms of all of the games, is yours Parasite Eve? No, it's Resident Evil. Right?
I think it might be Resident Evil 2 if I really sit down and think on it.
This is coming from someone who knows you very well. Resident Evil 2, I think, is possibly one of your favorite games of all time.
It's up there. Like, I like the remake too, but I played the second one so much as a kid because it was the first game that gave me, it had that A-B scenario system where what you did in one affected the other. And so there was just so much fun replayability in that.
Sure.
I really got down with that a lot. So
I'd
say that.
Mine, I'll say, I mean, I don't have a large breadth of experience when it comes to like a lot of horror games and stuff. So like I have a pretty narrow pool to pull from, but I think like the first, like my favorite one that really drew me in and like I couldn't put down and I had to just go through until I reached the end was, it was the Resident Evil remake on the GameCube.
Nice, dude.
Was the one that really struck me. But I'm going to toss this out as the game that like gave me the gnarliest like spine tingles and the creepy crawlies was PT.
Sure, 100%. Nice pull.
Which I still have on one of my PlayStations. I never deleted it, so I can still play that, but it's just like that weird, that loop that just gets more and more unsettling, and it's like I could never quite figure out how to make certain things happen or to, like, what was causing, it, like, end-of-game scenarios to happen to me that, like, there's no way I would ever be able to make it to the end of that loop. Like, ever, man.
Just because it creeps you out?
Well, yes, and, I would probably panic at a certain point and really kind of screw myself over. But what about you, Brooks?
So I have two games that have unnerved me in
Phasmophobia also.
Phasmophobia's of course, yeah. Good. So
yeah.
But that one doesn't unnerve me as much.
That was for me.
Sorry. Yeah, that's for you. and it has to do with the way I play my games. Usually I'm up late at night. I have the lights off, and I have my headphones on. So I'm invested. Alien Isolation.
There you go.
Psychopath, dog.
Which is one of the games I had to stop after a little bit.
Ooh, yeah.
Because it was like, okay, I just need that. And again, for the same reason, there's this indie game called Monstrum.
Okay.
I feel like I've seen it on Steam.
Yes, you have. You are on a ship. You don't know what happened because you were locked unconscious, but you are the only person on this big cargo ship, along with a monster of some sort. And the monster changes.
Nice. Like, that's cool.
Each time you play.
So what is this called? Monstrum? I'm going to write this down. This sounds cool.
It's an indie game, but, and each monster is different, has a different, abilities and stuff like that. And you have to avoid the monster, hide, but the cameras and alarms are still working. So it can track you in a way. So, you know, if you make too much noise, it will hear you. So, yeah.
Damn, that is, man, I already have a problem. You know, it's right now, we started recording it about, 7:30, it's dark out, it's fall time, 7:30 my time, it's dark out, usually at night I'm a little stony baloney and I go to let the dog out, and man, if I forget to turn the light on when I'm out there,
creep steady.
Like, dude, my heart's racing, I'm in the middle of the woods, I'm like, I'm running aside real quick. I'm like, Rupert, stay right there. I'm going to turn on the lights. I'm scared.
I'm flipping out, buddy.
I'm flipping out, man. So, like, just the thought of I have Alien Isolation downstairs on my shelf. I think I borrowed it from my brother a couple years ago, and he's just never going to get it back.
Nice.
But I'm also never going to play it. So it's like this weird hostage situation that doesn't need to exist. Better pony up, bro.
Yeah,
pretty great news, Brooks. I don't know if you saw, but they did announce that they are, they're starting work on part two now.
Isolation 2.
It's funny you mentioned that, dude, because I've literally been watching like YouTube compilations of people getting creeped out in Alien Isolation, and just like creep compilations still creep me the fuck out just watching them, knowing they're going to get scared and having somebody else there still.
Well, it
gets
it,
me.
It's doesn't so it well pick designed. Up the microphone?
Yeah.
I don't know if that one does. There might be a mod for it.
I think actually the Xbox.
I think you can turn it off.
Yeah, I think the Xbox versions definitely do.
Oh, with the Kinect, maybe. Because they also had it with like NBA 2K, where if you had it on and you scream like fuck, it would give you a technical foul for cursing.
Yeah, it would. I remember that.
Yeah. It was like 2K20 or 21, something back when the Xbox launched with the Kinect.
I would have no players. It was like 2K17.
Yeah. Okay. One of them, yeah. So I remember people were really pissed about that. And I know the new, I was just shared this somewhere, the new game based on the Quiet Place series, like, it has a option where if you can turn on a mic, and if it hears anything in the room, the aliens know where you're at. Yeah.
Yeah, no. I wouldn't be able to play that with my family around.
Yeah. Everyone we know would be screwed playing that game.
100%. Micah, too.
Yeah, especially Micah. She would be calling the aliens nerds. What up, nerds? Micah, oh, that's die. So great. Son of a bitch. Get out of here.
You brought up PT, man. I will say, like, one of the times when you come out and the light is swinging, and if you look up and you can just see Lisa up in the top, like, smiling at you, one of the creepiest things I've ever seen.
You're talking about up, like, behind the banister.
When she's on the balcony, like upstairs, yeah. And she's in the shadows, but you can see her teeth. Because yes. She's smiling in that weird, like, grimace, death grimace thing. Ah. Oh, dude. So creep.
Man, so creep. You just mentioned watching compilation videos of Alien Isolation. And, like, the fact that you know it's coming. Boys, let me tell you. I took my niece and nephew to, some haunted thing over the weekend up on one of our mountains. And, like, okay, so we're going as a group. There's four of us. And, you know, obviously anybody, if they're going to jump out, they're going to wait until, you know, they see the last person before they do anything. Obviously, right? And so somehow I end up in the back. Mm-hmm. And like, let me tell you something. My niece and nephew, 9 and 12, they're little psychopaths. Like, they, like, nothing bothers them. Like, apparently my nephew, when he was like 5 and 6, he had to have a second costume. Like, the other kid in school appropriate one, and then what he actually wanted, because he was just a little crazy boy, right? So anyways, they're up front for some damn reason, and I'm in the back. My brother's some, it doesn't even matter. But like, every time you enter a room, you know that there's somebody right around the corner. You know they're there. So like, even going in there, walking through a door backwards, you know, just to see where they're coming from, it didn't matter. You see them, and they start doing their creepy little shimmy at you. You're like, ah!
Yeah, every time, man. Yeah. You can stare them right in the eye. They can talk to you normally. They're like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then when they go, you're like, ah, fuck, you son of a bitch.
Like, I knew it was coming. I know you're there. Stop. It's like the loud noises, but like, not loud noises. Fast movement. Startling.
It doesn't help even if you know that they're there and they know that you're there. They're going to get you.
God damn it. And I will say, niece and nephew just giggling and laughing. Like, fuck you kids. Fuck them.
Looking
kids.
Back on it, I think one of the very first scary games I played was Alone in the Dark on my cousin's PC. And it was like the Lego, it was like Final Fantasy VII, like 3D polygons. But I remember that creeping me the fuck out. Like, there's a couple times. There's like one time when you enter the maze and the camera shifts to like the attic window and it's looking out and you're still controlling yourself down in this maze. But like, and it's never alluded to, but like literally on the left side of the screen, there's like this weird green faced guy with this fucked up ear and he's just staring at you because you're like watching it from the same viewpoint. It's, oh man, that used to creep me out so bad to think that somebody was watching me do the thing.
It's so crazy. Like, that whole era, between that and, like, what is it, Clock Tower 2, like, Scissor Man. Like, you look back at that, and you're like, how, what? But then I say this out loud, remembering full well that the tiger jumping out at me in Tomb Raider 1 scared the shit out of me every time, even though I knew it was coming.
The tank controls, wall masters, man. From Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time.
Oh, the fucking hands?
Yeah.
Dude, I don't care what it is, any game where if I'm swimming in the water and there are sharks.
Get me out
of
there.
No, sir. Fucking sir, man.
Oh, dude, if it's a game that lets you, like, hop out of the water from some reason, some, like, some physical impossibility, but you can, like, jump out of the water, I am jumping the entire way.
Get me out of here. Out of get me out.
Until I'm out.
So neither of you are big fans of Subnautica.
I like the videos, but again, I would never play it. I don't know. If that's another one that, like, because most of it is underwater. I could maybe do it, but, you know, yeah. I'm very selective with what I can play.
That doesn't really bother me in the game. Because, like, you can see what's coming. In a game where, like, you're hopping around, it's usually some shadow or just, like, a fin coming after you. But I don't like Subnautica to begin with, so.
What would bother me more in Subnautica is the giant Titan ones, because that's just, like, the uncanny vat. Like, the cartoon-style sharks don't get me, but, like, in Far Cry 3, when, like, you're swimming and, like, sharks can come up to you that look one-to-one, that fucking gets me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's really no way to combat them when you're underwater, right? In those games. Whereas in Subnautica, I feel like you have an easy way to escape, like one of those things.
A gravity weapon that you can use. A stasis gun, I think is what it is, or something.
Sick!
So you can get away from
these other games,
way.
You're like, swim
real life,
faster!
You're kind of, because not a whole lot works underwater.
Yeah.
I mean, when you enter the ocean, you enter the food chain, so.
Yeah.
Fellas, I gotta say, when it comes to John Carpenter, he and I have a few similarities. One of which is the fact that we like to do the own music to our projects. He is much better at it than me, though. So I just sample bullshit and write dumb raps over it.
He's pretty iconic.
Yeah, he fucking does most of all of his soundtracks himself, including this movie, In the Mouth of Madness. I also set it up. This is the final movie in what he calls his apocalypse trilogy that starts with The Thing, goes, the second one is Prince of Darkness, and the third one is In the Mouth of Madness.
Have quite a bit of time between them, too. Mm-hmm. I saw that earlier.
Yeah.
I would rate Prince of Darkness as easily the worst of the trilogy.
Yeah, I could say that.
And obviously The Thing is number one. The Thing's my favorite John Carpenter movie ever. Yeah.
Yes.
Like,
The
it doesn't get better
iconic.
Than that. Yeah. So I would put In the Mouth of Madness squarely at number two. And there is one theme I want to mention now. Also because specifically I think this one thing I say will also play kind of a part in Brooks's selection next week. That's called foreshadowing, people. Budgetary concerns. I think, obviously, this movie, it got its budget slashed by like $5 million. I think it was like a $15 million production, and then they cut it down to $10 million. From what I understand, that pretty much cut out one big effect, which, honestly, I feel what they got for the money, it wouldn't have changed much.
Already know the budget and the gross.
I don't know the gross at all. This is just doing... I do know the budget. It was $10 million or $11 million.
The budget was an estimated $8 million. And if it got cut down from 15, like, that is roughly half, and it only affected one effect. Like, that $8 million effect better have been fucking awesome.
And it doesn't sound like it would have been, because the big effect they talked that they had to cut and modify was the ending. He wanted the town to get sucked into some weird vortex thing, which also doesn't sound that complicated. I feel like I've seen that in tons of other movies.
But
it probably would have been more complicated in the mid-90s to do and make it look good.
Yeah. I feel like what they
ended up doing
here... It was
that weird transition
here?
Period with the CGI.
It's a little bit more, like, timeless. There's already a lot of stuff in this that, you know, along with a lot of the prior ones, namely The Thing, like, there's some things in The Thing that look great, and there's some that are just like, holy shit. It's not great to look back on in 2024, right? So this is also a big problem that is in this... Maybe not a big problem, but it's something that's very noticeable. And so I feel like something like that effect, it would just look really bad if the things that they already had going on in this, which were more practical to begin with.
Yes.
Like, I'm glad that they got it cut and they couldn't do that.
And even I feel like the one big CG thing that they did have in the movie, while it looks okay, it still is a little janky. And because that's the part where he's like ripping his face into. Open.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like there's a couple times when like the hands move, but the paper shake doesn't move. And it, again, it's early 90s CG. We're still treading water. And again, this is a small budget flick. But I will say what you do see the monsters. I don't know if you guys watched that behind the scenes footage, too. Like, God damn it. Show me more of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we want. That's our money shot. There were so many fucking things, and they're like literally maybe 45 seconds of this movie.
And not entirely in focus either. Like the ones
I was about to say, maybe it's 40, maybe it's 45 seconds, but it's like that super hyper fast, like cuts, like nonstop. Nothing ever lingers. And there are a couple of things that it does linger on that, again, doesn't look great. But some of the stuff that's on there for like brief glimpses, a lot of that stuff did look good. So it was kind of a weird picky choosy what they were actually going to focus on. Like, so weird.
But in tradition, I guess I'll try to give a rough breakdown, follow through, and then we can, you know, interject when we want to. So In the Mouth of Madness, a John Carpenter flick, so you kind of already know what we're getting here, stars the fantastic Sam Neill. We also have a fun little cameo from Charlton Heston. Forgot about him. And also, really weird, I forgot she's in this movie, but when Happy Gilmore's grandma shows up, holy fuck.
Hey, dude.
You also see Viggo the Carpathian.
You do, and it took me forever. I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And then I was like, oh, it's that dude from Ghostbusters too.
Yes.
So
you had him. At least, and you also
at least the physical actor, not the voice actor.
Yes, absolutely. And he's just got such an iconic, that flat nose. You know, and that curled lip.
It's just like he constantly has like a sneer or snarl on his face, it looks like.
You had him, but then you also had the writer of the book, Baron Wolfgang von Wolfhausen.
Oh, that's who that is? Oh, that is who that is.
Yeah, from Beer
Fest. That's who that fucking is. He's Sutter Kane. I'll be goddamned. Okay.
Yeah.
Eye-opener here. You're getting
crotched now.
Sam Neill plays an insurance adjuster investigator. So he, like, if somebody says they hurt their back at work, he follows them and takes pictures if they're lifting up car tires or shit like that. He makes sure that you're not screwing over the insurance company.
I like how you take like the smallest case possible when we're like introduced to him, like really catching this dude who lit his own house on fire, like in the with his wife. And he's also cheating on his wife. He's got this crazy reveal and he's like, yeah, this is Don't strain a muscle on your back, buddy.
Well, that's the one that I'm most familiar with is people, the back hurt scam.
Yeah.
Maybe because it was in like a lot of sitcoms as a kid. But yeah, he does catch this guy who's set stuff on fire and he goes out to lunch with his client. And while he's out at lunch, a crazed man comes out of the store across the street with a silver axe, which will become a frequent motif throughout this movie as well. And he bashes in the window right next to them. It's a great scene as like they're like turned away and he slowly comes up. It's a nice one-er. And then I wish the whole thing would have been a one-er. That's not how it starts, though. It starts with him having a mental breakdown. We see an ambulance pulling up to the mental hospital. And it pulls him out, and I know Sean liked this line because he texted it to us earlier, which was he kicks one of the orderlies in the balls, and then as they're still taking him away to lock him up, he says, what's he say, Sean?
He goes, sorry, he gets locked up in his cell, and he's
that's
like,
right,
begging to be let out, and he goes, I'm sorry about your balls. Honestly, it was just a lucky hit.
I want to wish that was like a mistake that happened in production, and Sam Neill was just playing it up or something. And then they just decided to go with it.
That would have been great. Yeah, if he was just like improvising and yeah. John Carpenter's like, no, that works. We're keeping that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so anyways, so Sam Neill at the start of the movie is had a mental break. So we're already familiar with that. And then it's like it does the Pulp Fiction Tarantino thing where it rewinds us back to show us how we get to this point. And that's when like the window gets smashed in, and then he gets hired by a book publishing company. And that's another weird thing to wrap your head around at first, is that like all of this is about an author that's bigger than Stephen King, who it's like implied that his writing is driving people insane. And then we come to find out that the person that attacked him with the axe in downtown Midtown was Sutter Kane, the author. It was his agent. And he just read the last book. And when he'd finished it, he went insane and was trying to stop anyone else from letting it get out, which is why, foreshadowing, he attacks Sam Neill, who I cannot remember his fucking name in this movie, and it doesn't matter.
His name's John Trent. And I do, Sam Neill's name is John Trent, and I do like the reveal later on in the movie of the actual reason why the agent attacked him when you look back at it. And it's not just like attacking anybody. This is the person he had to try to kill to save everybody.
But it didn't work. I also love that this it's our great first real clue. I mean, number one, there is a man going on an axe murdering spree in downtown Manhattan, which is just in itself odd. But we do get this great just like 2 second close up when he asks him if he's read Sutter Kane, that we see his pupils. He's got two pupils in each eye.
Yep.
And his eyes are like a shocking, striking blue, which will also become relevant later, which makes me worried about Sean.
It was very similar to the opening of Men in Black, where he is chasing down the guy and he gets him against the wall and he blinks twice.
With like sideways eyes?
Yes, with the two sets of eyes.
They were gills.
I was very surprised that he never mentioned it, that this dude had literally, it looked like he had booties for eyes, like the way that the blue is connected. It was not a perfect circle. It was so weird.
It was like overlapping.
You would
circles.
Notice this on like somebody a Venn diagram. And not, yeah, and not say anything to anybody. Like this guy is the worst when it comes to being an investigator and just yeah, like, you'd think... I don't believe any of this.
The worst. Yeah. So the whole time, so he goes, the insurance people for the book company hire him because Sutter Kane has been missing. He mailed in the last draft of his manuscript, and then nobody has heard from him since. And he's disappeared somewhere that they don't know. So they hire Sam Neill, who he believes that this whole thing is just an elaborate setup by the publishing company as like some sort of contest, like find where Sutter Kane is, win an autographed book, and he thinks they're bullshitting him for like the first half of the movie. But he takes it on because what they offer him like a lot of money, and I think he's just intrigued anyways because he got attacked by the guy's agent.
And plus he likes to bust cons. That's what he thrives on. He pretty much
I love
does
too
that.
This very mid-90s office environment, and I also loved how it is just absolutely fucking packed with people going back and forth. Like, John Carpenter just was like, give me every extra. And he just shoved them all into this one scene. There's like one part where like they're coming down those fancy glass stairs, and I swear there's like 20 people that go up and down and behind them.
Yeah.
But he like, I got caught up on all the extras because I thought that was funny. Oh, so they decide he's going to go. She's like, why don't you read some of his work and try to understand the man? So he goes to the bookstore and people are going crazy for wanting the last book. And like these weird people start talking to him in there, but he ends up picking up one of every copy. And then he has a nightmare with the gross cop beating the people up in the alley. Then we get the famous mid-90s horror movie wake up from a dream to still be in a dream, because then we find the same creepy cop on the couch next to him.
Non-stop.
Yeah.
Non-stop. He woke up from a dream like 9 times in a row in one scene in this movie. And that's like one of 7 scenes that he wakes up from a dream in.
I'm 90% positive that they had him, the cop, sit next to him also because, like, this guy is like, hey, man, you fucking made me sit in this chair all day to get in this makeup, and you're going to use me for one 10-second scene? They're like, all right, come on, we'll have him wake up next to you, too. But anyways, after his second wake up, I love that he is the first person to realize that, like, there's a red outline on each book cover. And I also like that each book was only designed by one art company, because if you've ever looked at any, like, every Stephen King book that's ever been published and republished, they have different covers because different publishing companies update the art style. But this one has had the same ones. It's only, does it also apply to the hard covers, or is it only these paperbacks that have this?
Okay.
Anyways.
So, like, I can believe it that these are probably first runs. These are as they're coming out. These aren't reprints from 20 years prior, you know? So, okay. I can believe it that these soft cover books, they could hypothetically use one person and they hid this one little Easter egg in it, that one Dan Brown-esque in like insurance investigator can figure out, you know? It's absolutely preposterous. But you're right. Like, if this was a hardcover book, he takes out the oldest pair of scissors that I have ever seen. Like, my grandmother had those,
like next to her
pin cushion that looked like a pumpkin. Okay. And he starts doing arts and crafts with these book covers. What are you doing with a hardcover? Nothing. Yeah. You're fucked if you spent the extra money.
I love the fact that, like, this is the most widely read book series in the entire world. It's been translated to, like, he says, what, 178 or whatever? How many languages? I forget.
Also, languages. To go on to this, though, around the 90s and late 80s, hardcover was not as common for these big horror novels. It was almost all paperback.
Listen, stop introducing logic into this, Brooks.
Hey, my dad has like a whole shelf of original print Stephen King. And all of those
original it's hardcover.
The original paperback ones, though. He has all of those.
But he so I just love the fact, again, the most widely read series. I've seen people that figure out, like, alternate reality games in, like, a day, but nobody has figured out that, like, oh, hey, all of these books have this weird red shape. I wonder if I cut them out and they fit into a puzzle, and that puzzle happened to be the state of New Hampshire, I believe? Yes. One of the upper...
Yeah, it was New Hampshire.
Yeah.
One of the Northeaster states, and right smack dab in the middle is this town called Hobbs End, which is one of the books that he's written too, The Horrors of Hobbs End. And everybody's telling him this is a town that doesn't exist. I don't know if you guys are picking up on this yet, but this story in of itself is a very Lovecraftian tale with all of this stuff.
So I got real silent at the beginning of this episode when you asked, is this better than Tales from the Hood? Mm-hmm. And up to this point in this movie, resounding yes. Resounding, I love... So, like, I love the fact that all of the books, all of these Sutter Kane books take place in or around Hobbs End. And that's awesome. I love that. That's very Stephen King. It's all one universe that Sutter Kane has built, and it's all, everything is kind of flowing through that. I love it. And that's it. That's all I wanted to say.
it's like a Castle Rock or Derry.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely a Derry type thing. But this one, it's like if you could go to Derry.
Grab onto Castle Rock?
And it would be terrible. but yeah, they're driving forever. Him and the girl that he's been assigned to go with him.
Linda Stiles.
At one point, she's driving in the night, and there's this pretty great scene of her coming up on somebody on a bicycle, and she passes and
it was
him
a kid.
And, yeah, a kid, and she passes him, and then like sort of a deja vu thing. She comes up to the same person on a bicycle, except now they're an incredibly old man and they're screaming, "He won't let me leave." And then we get another great scene where like it's just like the highway hypnotism where it's just the white lines, and then all of a sudden they just disappear. And then she rolls down the window and she looks down and she's like above a storm. I thought that was a pretty cool cut. And then when she flips out from that.
You did skip over the third part of this boy on a bike where so she passes the boy on the bike and then she passes the old man on the bike. And then she keeps going and she looks down at the map for a split second and smokes the guy on the bike.
Yeah.
So it's like the little boy was going in the direction of the car. And then the next two, they're going away from where she's headed as an old man. And that's when he's like, "He won't let me go." And the dude just gets off after getting smoked by the car and just rides
just
the bike
takes
away.
Off. That and was also pretty disappears. Creepy. Yeah, because he's fucking, laying there.
It was skin-crawly, man.
In a kid's voice, too.
Yeah.
Yes, he was talking in the kid's voice.
But yeah.
Oh, my God.
He's just laying there. And then like they're talking and they turn away. And then the next thing, he's just riding away.
Yeah, looks back he was like long legging away. Motherfucker looked like long legs.
Yeah, definitely did look like long legs.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
But he, so then they do another dream sequence thing, and Sam Neill comes to as Styles has somehow had them end up in Hobbs End. And so they go, and this is also very. Stephen King-esque, also a little Dean Koontz-y, where like you're in a town and just something is not right. Have you ever read Crouch Inn, Brooks? I'm sure you have. That's a great Stephen
Been a
King
while.
Short story. Yeah, it's a Lovecraftian one almost like this, where it's a couple in a New England town called Crouch Inn, and it's just everything's just a little off. Something isn't completely right. You've got the kids chasing the dog around in slow motion. This fucking church, man. I guess this church is like a real thing. It's not a matte painting. It's a weird-ass Russian Orthodox church out in the middle of nowhere. But I like that cut when, like, he thinks he's fooled her and he's like, "Yeah, but if this was Hobbs End, there would be this black church with golden onions right outside this window." And he opens it and it's like a warehouse or something. And Styles is like, "Yeah.
You should have been paying closer attention. It's supposed to be facing east."
And then she opens the window, and there is just like this fucking weird-ass black church in the middle of this forest. And we're like, okay.
The actual church's name is the Cathedral of Transfiguration, which is in Ontario, Canada.
That's gnarly. Okay, well, that was like half the budget was just getting them to Ontario, because... I can't imagine Charlton Heston was charging that much at the ripe old age of, like, old as dirt.
Old as dirt.
Well, I mean,
he was still alive for, like, another 15 years after this. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But then they show up at, so they go to the church, and Homegirl starts to realize that, like, she knows what's happening. She's read this, and, there's like a small child at the church and a family, or I'm sorry, an angry mob of townspeople is driving very fast up to the church. They get out with their guns and they're screaming for Sutter Kane. And so again, Sam Neill, looking for this guy, is intrigued, while Styles is like, "Nah, man, we need to get the fuck out of here." And Sutter Kane shows up for the first time, looking menacing and not at all like a beer baron, and summons his hellhound Dobermans on people, which apparently a lot of stuntmen ended up getting really fucking hurt in this scene.
That was cool as fuck.
Yeah, the dog's rolling out. There's like six Doberman just mauling people. And then we finally get, is this when we get to meet Happy Gilmore's grandma?
No,
we met him.
We
met
already
her earlier.
Okay.
Yeah, we already met Frances Bay because she's kind of like running the hotel that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And she's Miss Pickman. And so they end up going back to the hotel after this. And you have John Trent asking, like, this is where this movie completely fell off the rails for me. Like, completely. Like, and it never regained it for me, is that this character is the stupidest motherfucker in the entire world. And it like there is so much potential for this movie to just be so awesome, but there are so many things that are just so glaringly wrong that like he just overlooks for no goddamn reason.
Yeah.
So like he gets back and he's already mentally being like, oh, you guys set this up. You and Charlton, like, yeah, he ran away. You know, you hit him away, bloody blood, to sell more books. I'm like, cool, that's a good idea. She goes, yeah, we did do that, but it didn't go as planned. He just disappeared, bloody blah. But I've read this. I know what happens. And he goes, oh, well, it can't be like the book. Mrs. Pickman, the lady downstairs that's clearly got the same fucking name as the character in the book, she didn't hack her husband apart. How do you know that?
Yeah.
Like, and okay, spoiler you're going to say she totally she'll did. Put her dentures in his tea or something? Like, what a weird thing to say. You're so, like, gung-ho on everybody doing anything wrong, but you can't see anything that's wrong going on in front of your face. It was so infuriating.
While I will say it is very infuriating and you think it's stupid, I will say that is a very common theme in all of the H.P. Lovecraft books, is people that just don't see the super fucking obvious right in front of them until it's way too fucking late. They're just like,
oh, it's so obnoxious.
What? So I think that is intentional, as annoying as it can be. I want to say one thing I really like about the Hobbs End Inn is that when he pulls up, he's like, oh, hey, there's the greenhouse where the weird monster with snake arms is in the book. And then that thing is literally there later.
Yes. Great very fucking nice. Scene.
Yeah.
I love that everything comes around, and yes, it plays out exactly like these books that he just read. Mm-hmm. He just read all these books within like the last week, so it's still super fresh. He knows all of this stuff that is in this universe. But motherfucker, you're a pancake. I am watching someone with the intellect of a pancake. And like, at least if you're a waffle, you're a pancake. I like you.
Sean, oh, that got 2024. Me
good, Sean. That got me good, man. That was good.
I'm putting that shit on a t-shirt.
I like that. That should be the new experience grind merch. Motherfucker, you're a pancake. I'll get someone to design that bitch up. That's good. I like it.
See if I get Holly to do that.
So so John Trent slowly starts to really come together, like, oh, hey, maybe they're not pulling my fucking chain, because also, has he noticed the painting changing yet? That's another cool thing. Like the painting behind him is changing.
Styles noticed the painting changing immediately. He noticed when he went down to talk to Mrs. Pickman the first time.
Yeah,
actually he noticed when he went down when Styles like was taking the keys so he couldn't get away. I think this is after she went into the church. He noticed that the painting had changed and like the woman's face was all disfigured and the man's face was like kind of monsterish, but then it changes further later.
I like the third one where it just has the black church there and then these two weird Lovecraftian monsters.
Yeah,
I was like, that's a cool fucking painting. That I would was like gnarly. To get a I'd like to get a print of that to hang in my house.
Probably find it on Etsy.
I'm sure I can, actually. I should go look. Mrs. Happy Gilmore's grandma at one point, we do learn that she is torturing her husband. We see him handcuffed to her ankle, and she's telling him to hush at one point. And then when things really start to, the shit really hits the fan, and he returns the third time looking for her, and he goes to the basement, he sees her true, actual monstrous form with these weird tentacles. And she's got, again, the chrome axe, and she's hacking her husband to death like she did in the book. I think that's when he flees from there, and that's when he sees the monster in the fish tank? Or not the greenhouse?
Greenhouse, yeah.
But it is a little weird that he sees monsters there. I don't... Because the whole story is that, like, he's kept these monsters at bay, but they're essentially old world Lovecraftian gods, and they've infected Sutter Kane's mind, and they've given him power to create what he writes and bring it life. And they've inspired him through talking to him and communicating to him, because they want to essentially, they need people to believe in them so that they can gain power in our world, so that they can then come into our world and take it over. And that's Sutter an awesome Kane, concept, very Lovecraftian.
Sutter Kane, in essence, is the first of two mouths of madness. He is the one that is communicating this madness to everybody. So he is the first of two, and I do love that idea that they are the vision going to him, and he's the one telling the world of this madness and spreading it. Now, I want to jump in here real quick and talk about, seriously, if this dude is a pancake, like, I don't know if there's too much flour, not enough flour. This dude as a pancake is absolute garbage. Dude, this guy goes to the bar when this happens and runs into Viggo from Ghostbusters, right? And he's like, you gotta get out of here. And even then, he's like, man, you guys are good. You guys got good special effects. You guys got speakers everywhere. This is fantastic. You guys went really far to go and just make this happen. Like, dude, you just watched a lady hack her husband to death.
It still doesn't click for him until Viggo offs himself right fucking there in the bar, which is... This he is a rated R movie. This. I'm surprised we didn't get a. I'm again, it had to be a budgetary thing why we didn't get a sweet ass. I did love that it cuts to his
sweet,
hand and it's
sweet
like,
headshot.
It's dripping blood. Yeah,
headshot. Boom.
I thought his head was gonna explode. But okay, so I do have the ridiculousness of this, whatever the hell his name is, Trent, just being a complete bozo this entire movie. But you have Viggo in the bar, like his contemplation, like him trying to figure out, like, I just can't figure out if like we were here before Sutter started writing or if we're here because he started, like him just contemplating his existence. And that scene was so sick. Like that was such a sick scene. And then when he kills himself, he goes, when Trent's like, don't do it. And he's like,
I was written this way.
Kane's writing me to do this.
Yeah.
Whatever he said, it was so
sick. I was written this way.
Yes. That's the line. So sick.
And then, so then he returns back to the church. And we get Sutter's, this is where Sutter is now telling us, like, nah, man, this ain't me. It's them. And he points to this door behind him that's like this giant wood door that's bulging and it's creaking and it's slimy and it's gross. And he's like, they're the ones that have told me everything to write. I've just written the Bibles for them, but I can't hold them back anymore. And this is where we get the face pulling where he pulls himself apart. And then this is what, like, my one complaint with the movie, outside of the fact that, like, I would have liked to see more monsters, this ending, it's a little disjointed. I'm still not 100% sure what happens and why ripping himself open is the final straw to let the monsters come through. Because I feel like they already gained the power through him. I think they just wanted a cool special effect, really.
He was the doorway.
What I got... Yeah. From this,
that's what it was. Yeah. He was the doorway, so he was the final barrier for them to go through.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So we have this long extended. Okay, this movie is 1 hour and 25 minutes, and like I would still cut out like 90% of him trying to drive away in the car, at least two or three.
Oh, that when it keeps cutting and recycling and bringing him back. Yeah.
He keeps looping back. He passes the dude on the bike.
Yeah.
Until he figures out, let me just drive through all these guys. But then you've got Styles as the last person and he veers, even though Styles is a monster and he like, she's very clearly a monster. He's seen it.
Is that when she's already had the fucking head thing?
Yep.
Exactly. Dude, she was spider walking like a crazy person.
That was a really good practical effect, too.
Straight up.
I got it, man. So, after Sutter Kane rips himself in half, we get the giant, what they call the Wall of Monsters. It's essentially just, It was this weird contraption, a literal wall that they pushed on a cart, and then it had a couple of dudes in actual suits also walking in front of them. These essential old gods that have finally come into our world. And then it cuts back to Sam Neill telling all this to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist, of course, is like, no, this guy's completely fucking insane.
Yeah.
And he walks out the door, shuts it, and then, boom, the monsters are there. And Sam Neill hears growling, people screaming, lightning flashes, there's some blood splatter, and then everything goes quiet. And his door is open, and he walks out, and he's the last person on Earth. And he just keeps walking, and we, as he walks, there's just destruction everywhere. There's bloody claws, but there's nothing else. And he comes up to what? The movie In the Mouth of Madness, which they admit alluded to also at the earlier start of the movie. Like, hey, oh yeah, because he shows back up and he's like, it's been like, what, 6 months, 7 months? Yeah. And they're like, what are you talking about? We've already published the book. The movie comes out in 2 weeks.
And yeah, that's when he gets sent back.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost like everything was rewritten. One of the things that you glossed over a little bit is, so like he crashes the car, whatever, and he wakes up in the church. And it's at this point that you got Sutter Kane kind of explaining everything that's happening. You've got the the gods that are telling him to write this book. And it tells him that, like, he wrote Trent. He wrote John Trent. He is the person that has to bring – it's like this weird cycle, this, like, cycle – this weird cycle where he has to be here. He wrote him to be here to bring the book back.
Yep.
And to basically deliver it to the masses. Like, his only purpose is to be the one that essentially distributes this to the world. And this is why his agent, who is the only one that's read this book, tries to kill him at the beginning of the movie so it never gets to the point where this book can be distributed and the entire end of the world is brought upon. And the end of the movie is so dope that he is brought to the brink of insanity, realizing that he's just a fictional character that was brought into this real world by a writer.
Mm-hmm. And it's alluded to earlier on in the movie when he passes that poster and he tears it up. Open a little bit, and there is the picture of him in the Mouth of Madness, but you don't know that that's it until later on when you see the movie poster starring
John Trent, also written by John Carpenter and directed by it was a great little meta in universe joke.
The same exact cover or the same exact poster, just all of the actors' names were replaced with the in-movie names, which that was such a cool touch.
And I love...
Why has he got to be such a Muppet, man?
He walks into the movie, and I love that he walks in with popcorn. I love that John Trent stopped to get a bucket of popcorn, and as he watches the movie of everything he just went through, his mind snaps, and he just laughs like a complete psychopath.
Borderline cries towards the end of it, too.
Even further, he stops to get popcorn. Okay, who's making this popcorn?
Right.
That tells me this motherfucker stopped to make some popcorn to bring it into the movie to watch himself on the screen.
But yeah, and then he does do that. He's that laugh cry thing Brooks brought up, too, which is just Sam Neill. Fucking so good in this. He's so good at playing that psychopath. It's so weird because to me, he's always going to be Alan Grant. But goddamn, does he play murderous psycho so well.
I actually rewatched Event Horizon over the last couple of days.
Really?
Yeah.
Just to watch it, or because you guys wanted to do spooky movies?
No, I just had it on while I was playing Diablo.
And, nice, dude.
It was good.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it much better the second time. I enjoyed it much more the second viewing.
It is one of those, because you pick up on a lot of things.
You already kind of know everything that's happening, so you don't have to pay attention to the story beats. You can just kind of, like, look at everything that's in the picture. Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, it rewards you so much for just, like, really paying attention to the scenes. Very good. All right.
Well, fellas, we'll get into some ranking. I want to say, do you guys have any other favorite scenes or parts or things you want to talk about that I didn't get to bring up?
So, did you guys recognize the paper boy when John Trent comes back into the real world?
Yep.
A young Anakin Skywalker, Mr. Hayden Christensen himself, in his film debut. This was his very first movie. Wow, it was also the guy that played Viggo, his very last movie. He died not long after this.
Correct. Really?
Yeah.
Yep, this was the last movie he was ever in.
What was that man's name? It was
Wilhelm von Homburg. Mm-hmm.
My last name was Homburg.
Good cameo shots of a John Glover and David Warner.
John Glover was fantastic.
Oh.
I love that he's still alive. Anytime I see him in a movie, it makes me happy. Oh, yeah. I love me some John Glover.
John Glover is fantastic. David Warner plays these doctor characters, these bit parts, and generally some bad guys too. He plays them very well. I enjoy both actors. As well. So.
Who was the other person?
David Warner. He was the
David Warner. Yeah,
played the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
And of course, fucking the lovely Charlton Heston just crushing it as the fucking publisher.
Which I anticipated him just having kind of a little bit role when I saw that he was in the cast. He has one of the bigger, arcs in the story in terms of, you know, he's the one that hires him. He's got kind of a bit to do.
I also love
one room,
the intro and the post movie credits, that fucking
riff.
John Carpenter chugging guitar.
Opening was gnarly.
I loved it. I was like sitting there. I was like, oh man, I dig this.
Yeah. And that's John Carpenter.
How could you make watching a printing press feel so badass?
I know. Like watching how a book is being made. I was like, you know what? I could watch this for like a good solid 10 minutes. If I could just get that riff the entire time.
Yeah, man. Fucking A.
Yeah, so
I did start watching this movie at work because, like, to listen to it while I was doing some stuff, knowing full well I was going to get home and watch it again. Almost like the whole Event Horizon thing, so I can get the story beats and then really be able to watch it. I couldn't do that. ADHD, right? Am I right, boys? Anyways, so I heard the opening, got home, started watching in the living room. My TV was having audio issues where, like, the music sounded great, but I couldn't hear anybody talking. So then I cut it off from there and went into the bedroom. So I got to watch that opening three times.
Nice.
And I'm not upset about it.
Like, it's still good.
Dude, it was so random.
That reminds me of a group I've gotten into recently. Slightly off topic, but slightly not, because John Carpenter did a bit with this group called Dance with the Dead.
Okay, sick.
It's just like basically feels like 80s, 90s horror movie music, but like, you know, that synth
feel. He's got experience.
Nice. So,
ramping up that Halloween theme. Let's go, baby.
It's a good group to listen to around this time of year. Well, any time of year.
He's famously retired now. If you guys don't know what he does, he literally spends his day smoking blunts and playing NBA 2K, sometimes with Kurt Russell.
Wait, are y'all for real?
Uh-huh, 100%. That's what he does now.
Yep.
Plays a lot of video games. He fucking loves video games, man.
That's really fucking dope.
Well, that's, I think he streams. A lot of his video game community loves John Carpenter, so.
Oh, yeah. I fucking love John Carpenter, man. I'm so glad I got to do a John Carpenter movie this year, redeem myself from last year. Sean's been playing it close to the chest, but I think you like this movie a little bit more than I was led to believe. So,
maybe.
I want to jump into my rating system. I'm going to say I'll do me to Sean to Brooks, Brooks to me.
Yep.
Okay. Shawnee boy.
Yo,
if you were a demented writer who could write things into existence, and you were writing a murderous mob that was going to hack down one guy with from between 1 to 15 chrome-plated axes. How many axes are you using to hack this guy to bits?
1 to 15? I'll tell you what. The fact that this movie is roughly an hour and 25 to an hour and 30 minutes really, really helps it out. Because even then, there are parts of this movie that get really long in the tooth and really started to irk me. Like that looping driving away scene. Holy shit. By like the fifth time, I wanted to throw my TV out the door. I will give this movie... I'll give it 11 and a chrome-plated dagger.
Okay, nice.
This movie, it was really good. I was really, really, really enjoying it until, truly was really irritated with his character in, the second, in the third quarter of the movie. The first half feels great. I enjoyed the payoff, the ending of the movie. And I understand, now that I look back at it, he's kind of written to be oblivious about that stuff, if I'm going to take into canon the fact that he is being written this way. But it didn't make me any less irritated in the moment prior to knowing that. And it just made it feel... it felt like it was insulting my intelligence a lot, and I just don't like that. I did like the world that this was building. I love that they went to a town that is just having been established in all of these series of books. I think that the way that they got there was a little ham-fisted with the car just kind of teleporting there. There's a lot of weird stuff that complement how the great parts of this movie. So, yeah, I can't give it, a really, really high score. But also, it's not middling. I did enjoy this. But, man, there's a lot of things that really stuck out, really bothered me. But I enjoyed the movie. It's just easy to talk about the shit that bothers you. Brooks.
Yo.
You stumble into a town, which may or not be known as Hobbs End. It's legally distinct from Black Rock or Castle Rock or something. Who knows? Okay. And you're hanging out and you end up going to this church. You're not the leading man. You are actually the leading lady. You went there on your own because that seems like a safe thing to do in this really haunted town. But anyways, you show up there, and as soon as you get out of the car, there's a ball that bounces past your leg. And you turn around to see totally not Children from the Corn just standing there. Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 12 totally not Children from the Corn, how many totally not Children of the Corn are you giving this movie?
I am giving it 9 Children of the Corn.
Totally not, legally distinct, totally not Children of the Corn.
Yeah, totally, totally, totally not. Not even close to being knockoff. I enjoyed the movie.
Not nearly Puritan enough.
Yeah. I mean, it pays homage to, Lovecraft, both the good parts and the bad. So, I mean, there's some tropes in there that I'm kind of with you. The, car repeat. Yeah. Maybe once or twice. Okay. But as many times as it did, I don't know. Maybe it's the movie trying to drive me mad. I don't know.
Oh, that's a good point.
But
I just thought they were trying to hit a runtime.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's intentional to just annoy the person. I don't know. I don't know what goes on in John Carpenter's head, given how he comes up with some of the stuff.
I changed mine to a 12. That's meta.
It's still a solid movie. I still enjoy a good practical effects. And for the most part, these were good. I enjoyed seeing people in the movie that I like, oh, hey, I didn't know they were in this. And, you know, with Viggo and Anakin.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff like that. So it was pretty cool. So yeah, a solid 9. So, Kyle, you are making a monster movie, and you create a wall of monsters for this one scene that could potentially take up to 25 people to crew. How many people do you get to crew that machine?
I like this scale. That's very nice. On this... So I agree with everything that you guys have said, and I would honestly take it a little bit farther, although what Brooks just said kind of gives me, I don't know how much of this movie's disjointedness was intentional by John Carpenter, and how much of it is just due to this movie maybe being a little bit bigger for his britches than what he could do, which is weird to say because I think he kills it on the thing. But I think the thing on its scope is overall much smaller. This is a very big movie. And I think it stumbles in a few places. But like the disjointed storytelling is one that it's still, I like this movie a lot, but still to this day, like even giving that breakdown, there was so much that I miss and so much that you just gloss over because the movie just, it's like, oh, and we're in Hobbs End. Ta-da! I mean, I get that, like, why it's there, but it doesn't last in your memory as much. The wall of monsters lasts in your memory because they look cool, even though you see them for like 20 seconds. But
and the biggest why part you see there, them is they're out of focus because you're focused on Sam Neill.
But why they're there? It doesn't. And I again, if it's a meta like Lovecraftian thing because you can't comprehend the great ones and that's why it doesn't stick in your head. Cool. I don't know if it really is, though, so...
It's funny because that wall is the thing that I've remembered least about this movie.
Yeah. I remember it so much because there was one episode of the Discovery Channel show called Movie Magic that focused on that monster wall very heavily. And I remember, like, just loving that as a kid because I love that show. But back to the scoring system. Overall, out of 25, I'm giving this a 20. I think this is a really fucking awesome movie. It does a lot of great things. Sam Neill fucking carries this flick so awesomely, as he does in everything. I love that guy, and I love him more as I get older. He's so much fun as an actor to watch because he's like a McConaughey. He just kind of goes in all balls, man. He gives it everything to every role. It doesn't matter. You're going to get a good performance out of Sam Neill every time. So, But yeah, I the movie does definitely have its flaws too. It's nowhere near my favorite John Carpenter, but I would rate it much better than a lot of his other ones too. And I'm a huge John Carpenter guy, but I can admit the guy's got some stinkers. He's got some fucking ballers too, though. That's what good art is.
I do have kind of a way to take this that will get us into the budget and the things that I do from there. And it's actually kind of related to you saying like, you know, compared to other things. Well, going into this, I think it's tough to go into this movie without thinking about The Thing, which came out 12 years prior to this. And it's tough to, I think, finish this movie and talk about it. And not, like, I can't help but think that, you know, it's not exactly fair to him, but man, like, The Thing just, in almost every aspect is just a better movie. It looks better, the effects are better, it's lit better, it like everything about it seems more cohesive. So it's almost like it's almost a disadvantage for John Carpenter that he really did anything post The Thing. You know, because hard to watch anything with, unless they did something crazy and like had a baller budget and could make something that was just so far above and beyond. Unfortunately, they didn't, because The Thing had a budget of $15 million 12 years prior.
Wow.
We've already established that 12 years later for this movie, they had their budget cut from about $15 million down to $8
million. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Thing grossed about $20 million off of their $15 million budget. Did not do very well. You know, if you're actually looking at it in terms of monetary things.
I will say for a long time, The Thing was shit upon. A lot of people hated The Thing. Critics hated it. It did not get the recognition it needed until like 15, 20 years after it came out. So
way too late.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I imagine if that movie had the acclaim back then that it did right here, this movie would have kept that budget. He could have cleaned it. Man, I wish I knew what he could have done with double the budget that he had.
Mm-hmm.
Make it look better. Clean it up. Like, it's just such a dark. It's such a dark movie. The brightest parts of this movie is when you have the scenes of him in the asylum and he's written all over himself in crayon and like it's very bright, but it's also very insane, which I do appreciate. Anyways, this is a long-winded way of me saying this movie had a budget of about $8 million. What do you boys think that this movie made worldwide?
What was this release, 96?
94. Oh, 95. February 95.
Yeah.
Okay. Budget of $8 million worldwide. I remember this getting marketed very heavily. It did have the movie Magic tie-in. I'm going to say it pulled in 18 mil.
Rex? I'm going to go 25 mil.
Boys, that's a drum roll. I'm really bad at those. This movie was a big ass stinker. This movie made $8,900,000.
Damn.
Woof.
So it barely broke even.
And those things famously don't have marketing budgets. So usually when we see them break even there, they still lost money because you got to, even for the, like I said, I remember seeing this everywhere. There's probably $4 to $5 million on top in marketing for it. And
Yeah.
Damn shame.
But, I mean, what this movie can take from it is that it still made more money than Joker 2. By a long shot. Yeah. Who's laughing now?
So what? Next week we got Brooks's choice up with The Void. And then what's week four? We decided it, but I can't remember.
Salem's Lot, the new one.
Salem's Lot, the new one. So this... just confirmed, will actually be a special episode because spoiler alert, I'm going to record episode 4 with Brooks.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, I'm gonna be, me and Mandy will be back in Indiana visiting family. And I was racking my brain like, fuck, dude, how am I going to do this episode when we're in Indiana for a week? Are we going to record early? And then I was like, wait, fucking Brooks lives right there. Just go hang out with Brooks and record. So, we'll just be set up that way. It'll be a fun time. We'll hang out. So for the fourth episode, it'll be a little bit different energy. I'm excited though.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm. That's really awesome, boys. I cannot wait to see you guys.
Now, if Sean can get a plane ticket.
Oh, that ain't happening.
He's like, dude, I am not going to Indiana.
Listen, boys, that. I was notorious for buying plane tickets last minute. And let me tell you, it's much cheaper if you don't.
Yeah. We only told you that for 10 years, Shawnee, but
leave me alone. I had a shtick. Okay. I had a very expensive
I had
shtick.
A bit I was committed to. Thank you very much. No, I'm looking forward to that. It'll be fucking great to just to see Brooksy in general. I love the fucking guy. I've only seen him digitally for a couple years, so looking forward to that. It'll be a good, fun time to hang out and record in person. We'll laugh at Sean because he's through the screen. Ah, I can't wait. I'm looking forward to The Void. I'm looking forward to talking to you guys about that next week. I think it's a fucking awesome, awesome movie. Spoiler alert. I'm excited to see what you guys think. I will say its biggest thing that it wears on its sleeve is its love for the movie The Thing. So
beautiful.
Take that with you, fellas. Until then, Sean, why don't you tell the listeners what they can do until next week?
Folks, you can go love craft yourself.
Oh,
so we're Kirsten Dunst in it as Claudia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Holy shit, it's really weird to see her so young, like as a child, but she's okay,
clearly
this is
recognizable
weird, but she has the same exact face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it looks like someone just CGI removed
her face. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
And put it on a small child. Dude, it was tripping me out.
Her jet curly hair adds to that effect too.
Oh, man, it was so
that fucking movie
weird, dude.
Rules. Who's up for Would You Rather? Whose turn is it?
I believe, let's see, I'm ending it.
Oh, so is it me? I think that's the way we did it. Sean did it last week for his movie. Now it's me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, let's go with that. Oh, I did do it last week. Let's go!
Okay, here's the thing. I'm going to ask Brooksy. Brooks, would you rather get chewed upon by an otherworldly fourth dimensional Lovecraftian being or a vicious fucking Doberman pincher?
You know what? This is probably one of those instances where I think I will go with the something I haven't had done to me before, and that's chewed on by a Lovecraftian creature.
Oh,
I've been chewed on by a dog, but... No, unless my wife counts as a Lovecraftian creature, but...
Oh.
No.
I'm absolutely going with the Doberman, because at least I know that thing's going for my throat. Dude, a Lovecraftian thing's going to toy with me, probably.
It's going to get its tentacles in your brain before it gets its fucking weird... I like the one that had, like, the cone of teeth out of his... That guy was awesome. I wish you could see more of these things.
The tentacles out of his mouth.
Yeah.
It's like a freaking mind flayer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right, boyos. Mwah.